Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting from the road. Have a lot to share today. My opening will be on the latest of how to heal the body using a lot of natural approaches, also brain diseases. They're affecting more people and starting earlier than ever before. What we can expect from yoga, new information on L-carnitine and why it really is a superstar for your heart. My guest in the second part of our program, Professor Steve Hallett, who is a leading botanist and plant pathologist at Purdue University, will talk about the efficiency trap. Why are we thinking about becoming more efficient with our resources and energy and agriculture is fundamentally flawed, and why we should think in terms of resilience and conservation. I don't know how many I'll be able to get to, but I'm going to try to get to several commentaries and issues. If you watch 60 Minutes, then you, I'm sure, were questioning, why aren't you asking the hard questions about the FBI, its history of illegal activities? We're going to ask those questions in our fascism segment, how America's becoming is a fascist country at this time. The Department of Homeland Security routinely spies upon all protests. Then we'll look at a topic that is almost never discussed, from Alice Bell, The Guardian: challenge but don't worship the high priests of science. Very brilliant insight that Alice shares with us. From Chris Hedges, from Truth Dig, Rise Up or Die. Hard hitting. I'll give you part of that commentary. Also today, from our environmental segment, and I'm increasing our environmental segment daily, a former Monsanto employee is put in charge of all the GMO papers in a major journal. Therefore, that Monsanto employee will determine which papers are good for publication and which are not. Well, then, what is the likelihood we're ever going to see another article critical of GMOs in a publication? I doubt we'll ever see. The Monsanto Protection Act may be repealed thanks to grassroots activism. Give you the latest on that. Four examples from Tara Lohan of that Obama is full of hot air on climate protection, the four things he promised and the four things he does. An interesting piece I read from Thomas Magstadt, Dancing Towards Doomsday, Five Signs the Table is Set. Interesting, though I believe we can do a lot with it, so we don't have a doomsday. And from Ralph Nader, The Age of Corporate Treason. So, as you see, we have a lot to share, from guests on topics that impart insights to all of us, health and nutrition, commentary, social issues. We have a packed show. Let's begin. The latest on why you should consider yoga comes from New York University's Langone Medical Center. They found that yoga, quote, would be a useful adjunct in the lowering of blood pressure in certain populations. This was also done over 6 months with the University of Pennsylvania that tracked men and women, 38 to 62, and yoga was very beneficial. So one more reason to do yoga: lowering blood pressure. We think of all the colorful vegetables and fruits, and indeed we should. Blueberries and pomegranates, as an example. But don't forget the white vegetables. They're extremely valuable. Now, there was some insight about 15 years ago that you should stay away from all white vegetables because they could cause arthritis and inflammation. First, that was a half measure of truth. There are nightshade families like the eggplant and some white potatoes that in sensitive individuals who've tested for their inability to take those, you should exclude them. But now we have gotten so focused upon the colored vegetables that we're not looking at the whites. Here are the white vegetables that are loaded with phytonutrients and minerals and antioxidants. According to Advances Nutrition, a peer-reviewed journal, quote, it is recommended that the variety of fruits and vegetables consumed daily should include dark green and orange vegetables, but no such recommendation exists for white vegetables, even though they are rich in fiber, potassium, and magnesium. Overall, Americans are not eating enough vegetables, and promoting white vegetables, some of which are common and affordable, may be a pathway to increasing vegetable consumption in general. And there's an article called A Forgotten Source of Nutrients from the American Society of Nutrition. Here are the ones I would recommend on a regular basis. They can really do a lot for your overall good health. Mushrooms, onions, cauliflower, turnips, and kohlrabi. Now, kohlrabi is really good. Almost no one I know ever uses it. But it's easy to make. You steam it, peel it, then you can slice it and stir-fry it. You can put it in a fruit processor and make a make almost like a tangy dip from it. But it's very good. So those are some white vegetables to start including. I have a major program that's commencing in September and October. And it's directed towards the 100 million individuals over 40 and what they should be aware of concerning their brains. This is the latest, and this is from a Professor Colin Pritchard, published in the peer-reviewed journal Public Health. Quote, a sharp rise in dementia and other neurological deaths in people under 74 can be put at the fact that we are living longer only partly. The rise is because a higher proportion of older people are being affected by conditions at an alarming rate, especially those under 55. Let me just put this in context. Of the 10 biggest Western countries, the United States has the worst increase in all neurological deaths. Men up to 66%, women 92% in the last 30 years. We're just doing terribly on this front, and that's because we're not willing to be honest about the impact of stress, environmental pollutants, and our diet and alcoholic beverages on the brain. So now there's a big movement to try to determine what exactly goes on in the brain and how we can slow down its aging and even reverse it. This is from Professor Pritchard. Quote, these rising neurological deaths with the earlier onset of the dementias are devastating for families and pose a considerable public health problem. It is not that we have more old people, but rather more people with more brain disease than ever before, including Alzheimer's. Now, he didn't explain why, but we know why. And since I've spent my entire adult career in anti-aging medicine, studying it as a scientist and helping people in the sit-down sessions, I can tell you that we can get a handle on this. We can reverse short-term memory loss and dementia and Alzheimer's. But you can't do it piecemeal, and you can't continue to do a lot of things that are unhealthy and do a few things that are healthy. But that'll come in the fall when I do a whole national campaign. I'm just letting you know that more and more people are finding themselves in this situation. I'll give you one good example. 6 weeks ago, I spent time with an older man in his mid-80s who had problems with his own heart, but when he went on a strict vegan and organic diet, all of his heart problems went away. When he celebrated with some friends and started eating meat again, one meal, his heart problems came back at 4 o'clock in the morning, had to be rushed to the hospital. Went back onto a strict vegan diet and has improved. His wife now suffers from Alzheimer's. His daughter, who was very much into health, now is taking for the last year and a half, care of the mother, she's gained weight, tremendous amount of weight. She's stressed, and she is sick. And when I explained that the people who die the fastest in the United States, in any group, are caregivers, because they frequently don't see an end in sight. And when you're taking care of someone with Alzheimer's, it's a 24/7 job. And the stress, because it's a loved one, you're seeing them going further and further into that dark place where they can't communicate, don't even recognize you, can't take care of themselves. So the question was, can this be improved? And the answer is yes. And already there's been an improvement in this short period of time. But that's because the person's consuming no inflammatory items at all and consuming massive amounts of juice spaced in small quantities, but every hour throughout a day. And those juices are designed specifically to detoxify, chelate out heavy metals, because lead, cadmium, mercury, and aluminum are the big four that you want to get out to help your brain, because they're all neurotoxic, even small quantities. And they won't go out of the body on their own. You have to take them out. So using natural vegetables and nutrients that will grab them and take them out is crucial. And then you go in to repair the damage. In about 4 weeks, I will invite the father, the daughter, and the mother on the program. And let's see what kind of conversation we have with the mother with advanced Alzheimer's that was receiving no beneficial treatment at a major New York University's Alzheimer's Center. So I'll bring the whole family on the air, because they're all on the same identical protocol. They're all doing the same thing. So let's see what happens to the father's heart markers that were, you know, that were elevated, and the daughter's markers as well. That'll be in about a month. As you know, there was a very irresponsible piece by the mainstream media that condemned L-carnitine as harmful to the heart. What it did not tell people, it was the meat that is harmful to the heart, and by itself, as a standalone indicator, meat consumption is really harmful to the heart. Also, they destroyed good bacteria in the laboratory model in order to create a toxic environment in the intestine. And the media didn't tell anyone that. And then they found, you end up creating a TMAO in the gut, which is a trimethylamine N-oxidide. And they blamed carnitine. No, you should have blamed the red meat. Otherwise, it's like the completely fraudulent science where they took a group of monkeys and for years, injecting blood from persons with full-blown AIDS, they couldn't create a single case of AIDS. So then they gave the monkeys chemotherapy, and they destroyed their immune system. Then they ended up with some symptoms similar to AIDS, but never defined as AIDS. But they didn't tell people, we destroyed their immune system. Well, you could do that with any human being or animal. There's so much bad science. Here's the good science. This is all from peer-reviewed literature. And here's what it has to say. Carnitine is one of the most single important nutrients for your heart. Why? It transports fat to the mitochondria of your heart cells, where it is burned for energy. Now, unlike any other organ in your body, your heart runs mostly on fat. And without carnitine, your heart's fuel supply is compromised. And just like a car, your heart can't run without fuel. And that's why there's an enormous amount of evidence showing that carnitine improves heart health, but does not harm it. Here's what it can do that is proven by the scientific literature. It can improve your blood lipids. It can lower blood pressure. It can improve heart rate. It decreases death rates in heart attack survivors. It increases the blood flow to the heart. It relieves symptoms of congestive heart failure. It decreases angina, which is chest pain. It slows the progression of atherosclerosis. And it increases exercise tolerance in patients with heart and vascular disease. So That's the bottom line. All those positive effects, that's what the good science shows. Ginger. Ginger's a great, great nutrient. Comes as a root. Here's the latest on what it does from Columbia University. And this was at a major international conference. It says the following. Ginger is able to help treat asthma symptoms. Now, we know that asthma is characterized by bronchoconstriction and a tightening of the bronchial tubes that carry air into and out of the lungs. So bronchodilating medications called beta enhancers are amongst the most common types of asthma medications and work by relaxing the airway and its smooth muscle. And so this study looked at whether specific components of ginger could help enhance the relaxing effects of bronchodilators. And they found that, yes, asthma works in this way. One more reason to have asthma. And finally today, reasons why you need a mango every day in your life. Well, let's just take a look at it. And mangoes are delicious. And there are hundreds of varieties. And it helps fight cancer. Quercetin, isoquercetin, fistin, gallic acid. These are all natural chemicals in mango that protect against colon cancer, breast cancer, leukemia, and prostate cancer. Mangoes keep your cholesterol down and in the normal range, and that's what you want, because mangoes are high in vitamin C and pectin and fibers, and pectin, fibers, and vitamin C help lower cholesterol levels. Also, mango is one of your best sources of potassium, and that's important in maintaining body cell fluid control and blood pressure. It alkalizes the body. It's rich in what is called tartaric acid and malic acid and citric acid to help maintain alkali reserves in the body. It's good for weight loss. It regulates diabetes. In fact, not only the fruit, but the leaves of mangoes are healthy too. And it has aphrodisiac qualities. It's known as the love fruit. Mangoes have been used to regulate sex hormones and boost libido. It helps with eye care. It's a very rich source of vitamin A, precursor. It helps in digestion. It contains enzymes that break down proteins. It helps with strengthening your immune system. And it aids in concentration and memory. And it also is good in iron for women, especially during their period. And it reduces kidney stones. And it's a great stomach tonic. You get someone who has an upset stomach. If you put some mangoes into a blender and a little dash of cinnamon and anise, and you blend that, and then you have them drink that, that's terrific for them. So all the reasons to have a mango each day in your diet. I'm Gary Noll, and I'm going to do one more report before we go to our break, come back with issues. Last week, I did a one-hour presentation on why I would have counseled Angelina Jolie differently. I would have prepared all the scientific literature showing her that there was absolutely no reason in the world for her that's legitimate to have removed healthy breasts. And that the science behind the so-called BRCA1, BRCA1 gene is not 100%. It's a mathematical model, a probability. And it's been wrong time and again. Therefore, why mutilate yourself? There's no need to it. Also, just common sense and reason. Is that gene the only cause of breast cancer? And the answer is no. So I took a look at every study in the scientific literature on breast cancer causation for the last 30 years. And environmental factors are by far and away the biggest contributing. Environmental exposure to synthetics, pesticides, alcohol consumption, smoking, chemicals, high levels of heterocyclic amines from meats. These are the primary causes. And then I also looked at, so you take away the gene, if there was no other cause of breast cancer except how this BRCA gene expressed itself, would you be preventing breast cancer? The answer is no. But what about other cancers in the body? Would you then take out your liver because you're not going to stop drinking? Would you take out your kidneys for the same reason? And what about brain cancer? Are you going to stop using your cell phone? What about colorectal cancer with all the meat and alcohol, and stomach cancer with alcohol and caffeine? So you begin to see that the fact that you've mutilated your body, you sacrificed your body in a way that is being grossly exploited, doesn't mean that you're going to prevent any other cancers from occurring. And that is part of the lesson I felt that people did not know, and that's why I did the one-hour special. You can download it. It's on our archives. This is from Jonathan Landsman. I'll quote him from Natural News. And here's what he says. Angelina Jolie has, quote, not been told the whole truth about the BRCA1 gene or her risk of getting cancer. Many of us have heard the conventional talking points that refer to a, quote, 87% higher risk of breast cancer if one tests positive for the BRCA gene mutation. But I'm here to tell you that this is a complete fabrication of medical truth. The National Cancer Institute published what should have been an eye-opener. The BRCA1 gene may not really be the cause of breast cancer. Here it is. Listen, and you'll see what he's referring to. Quote, this is from the National Cancer Institute about the BRCA1 and 2 gene mutations. Quote, it is important to note, however, that most research related to BRCA1 and 2 has been done on large families with many individuals affected by cancer. Estimates of breast and ovarian cancer risk with the 1 and 2 mutations have been calculated from studies of these families. Because family members share a proportion of their genes and often their environment, it is important that the large number of cancer cases seen in these families may be due to, in part, to other genetic or environmental factors. Therefore, risk estimates that are based on families with many affected members may not accurately reflect the levels of these mutation carriers in the general population. In addition, no data are available from long-term studies of the general population comparing cancer risk in women who have harmful BRCA1 or 2 mutations from women who do not have such mutations. Therefore, the percentage given are estimates that may change as more data become available, end quote. What do you want to bet that Angelina Jolie never read that, nor did her physicians? I mean, that is an important statement, and this is the official statement, that there are many, quote, wide variety of environmental factors for breast cancer. Let me just put this in the most basic terms. The National Cancer Institute really doesn't know scientifically how much of any risk factor causes cancer, including the presence of this BRCA1 mutation. That's the reality. I'm reading and interpreting directly from their journal. And also, she doesn't come from a large family. And she had an extremely unhealthy lifestyle, some of which played out in the press. So then shouldn't someone have questioned her and explained that it was her lifestyle that could put her at risk for all forms of disease and other cancers, not these genes? So that's the part of this that is not known. This is from Dr. John Ashbley, medical doctor. Quote, what folks need to know is that genes can only express what they are fed. If they are fed a polluted diet with toxic immediate environment, they will express disease. With proper diet and detoxification milieu, genes will almost always express resilient, thriving cells, never cancerous cells. Unless we learn this, we will end up amputating most body parts by the end of this century. My heart aches for Angelina, and I wish her the best, end quote. There was an article that we found in the Journal of Cell Biology. This is a main journal, and this was by a team led by Susana Gonzalo. And it illustrates our ability to dramatically reduce the risk of breast cancer, even with the BRCA1 gene mutation, without the need for surgery. And here is what they found. They found that it was vitamin D provides a safe and cost-effective way to prevent breast cancer. But then from the medical journal Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers and Prevention, they look at the benefits of selenium for women who have mutations in the same gene, and it was protective. The selenium was. Then another study, specifically for women of high risk of cancer due to family history and genetics and the BRCA1 mutation, they found that it was in the lifestyle and the diet. These things are simple, and there are many more. So, but unfortunately, the media is caught upon this and praising her, and it's just incomprehensible how many women will now be sacrificing their bodies at the altar of science. And because of that, we put science ahead of so many others, including common sense. We now have absolute irrefutable proof that the synthetic hormone replacement therapy that is given to women, menopause and postmenopausal, will increase their risk of heart attack, stroke, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, colorectal cancer, and dementia by a minimum of 13%. We also know that about 10 million American women every day use this. That means that in spite of all the science showing that it is not needed at all and that it's extremely dangerous, we put at least 1.3 million women's lives at risk every day. If you told those same women, we can help you, we can protect your health, we can turn off night sweats and hot flashes, and we can reverse the symptoms of menopause, it's just a matter of reversing your lifestyle. An awful lot of women would then have their lives improved and saved, but we don't do it. So it's not the first time that women have been used and abused. But take one as an example who's popular and praise her so other women line up. And no one's looking at the amount of money that these industries are making off this exploitation. This is what Alice Bell had to say in The Guardian. And this is just how bad science has become, corporate science, even science itself. Here's what she says. Challenge, don't worship the chiefs and high priestesses of science. If we don't recognize the politics of science, we will just get played by those who do. At the British Science Association Science Communication Conference this week, I was invited to speak about science policy under the title All Hell to the Chief. Except I think science involves way too much hailing already. I'm not about to start bowing to Sir Mark Walport just because he's the government's chief scientific advisor. Science today and the way we share it with the rest of the world is based on layers upon layers of deference. We spend our lives crawling up to senior scientists and those who pay them, sitting and waiting to be told what to think. The Government Office of Science, Technology and the Science Media Center, journalists, museums, school curricula, and a host of other systems for sharing science act as filters for scientific information, choosing which is the most important, useful. This is what makes it so useful. But such choices are always going to involve more than simply science, and we need to recognize this. We've been here before. It's the critique of the so-called deficit model. Many of us have been dancing it for decades. The deficit model assumes that science has the knowledge the public are deficient in, and that many of our social ills will be solved if we all listen to the experts. It'd be a nice idea, maybe, if science, the media, policy, or people were that simple, but they're not. The deficit model sticks around partly because it feeds scientific social status, implicitly underlying their powerful position as people who get to define what counts as important, true, and reliable knowledge. Stephen Hillgartner put it well back in 1990, saying such top-down approaches implicitly provide the scientific establishment with the right to print money, something we don't appreciate, even though is it also serves the handmaidens of the deficit model, science communication professionals, less powerful scientists, many science fans, offering them some social status by association. Play into a game of hierarchies, and even if you don't get to the top, you get to climb a bit. Pierre Bourdieu, in his classic Sociology of the Universe Campus, Homo Academicus, talks about the way students are happy to submit to the idea that they are inferior to the senior academics because doing so earns them subsequent admittance to a distinguished club of graduates. I think we can see similar patterns at work in terms of the way academic ideas are shared outside the universities, too. By valuing expertise in society doesn't mean you have to unquestionably listen to those labeled as expert. End quote. Now, what's the takeaway message for me in this? It's several. First, look at the state of New York and its body politics, corrupt to the core. And the most powerful person in the state is not the governor. He's chump change compared to the person who runs the legislature in Albany, who's run it for 19 years, a man named Silver. And the New York Times did a really good piece on this yesterday, explaining how no matter what your ideals when you're elected at the local level to serve at the state level, you have to obey the rules that he sets out. He's the one who determines who's going to get on which committees and how much of a stipend you'll get and how much power you'll have. He is the one who delegates everything. And as a result, you have to abide by his rules because you can't make up your own or you'll have no power at all. So it's all about deference or deferring to power. And we do this in every institution, every corporation, even in a nonprofit radio station. It's all about who is the person or persons who make the decisions, and then they are assumed to have this unique place of judgment, and they shouldn't be challenged. And as a result, anytime you see a scandal, whether it's the IRS, and its scandal, or Homeland Security or the FBI or any of their scandals, and all they have are scandals, or corruption inside of the political parties or corruption inside of corporations or corruption inside the media. Why did you kill the story at Fox Network when your reporters found that the bovine hormone that's used in milk could cause cancer? But you can't get in the door unless you play by their rules. And their rules are, we'll nurture you. You'll have some power. But you're a part of us now. So you're no longer you. Your values, your moral, your ethics are no longer your own. And it plays out in science. There are now 3,000 of the finest scientists and critical thinkers, medical doctors, and journalists in the world who all have agreed, after looking at the facts, that everything we've been told about AIDS is a lie. And yet, none of them are given a forum. None of them are allowed to question the status quo. A completely corrupt system of the entire AIDS establishment exists, causing untold death and suffering. But the people on the inside, they're all protected, and they're all gifted for playing the party line. The same is true when a teacher speaks out and is put in a rubber room, and other teachers say, gee whiz, if I'm critical of my union, if I'm critical of the curriculum, if I'm critical of how the student is taught, I'll be harmed. But if I go along, no problem. So in all of our institutions, people have a tendency to go along. And some of the most susceptible and vain are the scientists. If they don't discover it, it couldn't possibly exist. So an entire area of medicine and healthcare, they've simply negated because they couldn't control it. It wasn't in their paradigm. And we have this elitism that also mocks honesty. And so if you're an honest person and a reasonable person, if you're a creative person, you have to understand what you have to compromise to go along. I once spoke with a leading scientist in a major cancer institute who sat on advisory boards and sat on peer review boards, and he said this to me. And we disguised his voice, but I had him on the air. And he said, "Gary, I sit across from people who've been given millions of dollars a year to do research for decades, and they've never created a unique thing in all that time, and yet for the rest of their life, they'll continue to come back every single year and get more grants, expand them, and some of them have massive facilities, and they've never done a damn thing, but no one will ever be looking at it because they, in turn, decide if you're going to get your research grant. So everyone protecting their surf, everybody protect or turf, everybody protecting their own self-interest decides to give to the other so they get for themselves." He said the entire system is completely and totally corrupt. He was right. And so when we look at how many billions and hundreds of billions of dollars we spend on disease and spend on different efforts, and we ask, where are the results? The media will never discuss results. They'll only praise efforts. And that's true at everything we do. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment with our guest. Please stay with us. To this program, I'm Gary Nall. We want to thank all of you for listening around the world, and a lot of people are listening over the telephone. I'm talking about millions upon millions upon millions of minutes, and tens of thousands. So if you're listening on the phone, it's 619-550-0869, 619-550-0869. Others are downloading the show, listening at night over TuneIn.com. Stitcher.com, iTunes.com, or PRN.com. To my guest in a moment, who is standing by, that is Professor Stephen Hallett. He is a British environmentalist and an associate professor of botany and plant pathology at Purdue University, where he specializes in plant pathogens and weed science and herbicide resistance and soil microbiology and agriculture and natural systems. He's been involved in bioherbicide research and development for 18 years, and he's also a faculty advisor to the university's Full Circle Agricultural Program. He has two important works, Life Without Oil, which looks at the problems faced with peak oil scenarios, and his most recent publication is The Efficiency Trap, Finding a Better Way to Achieve a Sustainable Energy Future, which details why our efforts at efficiency in resources and energy is contributing to higher consumption and further threatening a sustainable future. Professor, we're going to come to you in just a moment, all right? But because you're dealing with an environmental issue today, I just wanted to bring people up to date quickly on a few things. This is from Anthony Gucciardi from Natural Society. Quote, the so-called Monsanto Protection Act, signed into law earlier this year, caused such an outrage that people around the world are planning to protest the biotech company later this month. Now, a U.S. senator is expected to try and repeal that law after mounting pressure. The notorious Monsanto Protection Act rider, stuffed into non-related Senate spending bill, may soon be repealed thanks to the massive amounts of activism and outrage that have now amounted to a legislative full frontal charge. The senator is Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon, who has announced an amendment that would remove Section 735, the Monsanto Protection Act, as it is known, from the Consolidated and Future Continuing Appropriations Act of 2013 Senate spending bill. So my suggestion, I would like everyone in this audience who believes that Monsanto should not be protected, but the public should, to contact your legislator and say, yes, please support Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon and remove Section 735, the Monsanto Protection Act, as it is known, from the Consolidated and Further Continuing Appropriations Act of 2013 Senate spending bill. All right, I think it's very important that we do that. Separately, a former Monsanto employee has now been put in charge of GMO papers at the Journal, and new article exposes industry attempts to control scientific, and here's what it says. This is from Independent Science News. It says, just months after a study was published showing that the two Monsanto products, a genetically modified GM maize and Roundup herbicide, damaged the health of rats, the journal that published the study appointed a former Monsanto scientist to decide which papers on genetically modified foods and crops should be published. And so the journal is the Food and Chemical Toxicology. So now they had published a landmark study showing how bad GMO was and causing tumors and premature death in rats. Now Richard Goodman, a former Monsanto researcher with close ties to the biotech industry, is now on the senior editorial staff with a special, specific assignment. He's the one who gets to read the articles and decide which are published and which are not. I just think this is deplorable. Let's now go over to my guest who is standing by. Nice to have you with us today.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. Our civilization has a... we have to take an honest look at what we're doing as humans. And can we do anything better than nature? If our technologies benefit us in some way but are destructive in others, then we can we simply create new technologies to abate the earlier problems? Now, this then gives rise to the further problems, and so the equation continues in this manner. At least for me, it's clear now that technology won't save us. And yet rarely do we step back and attempt to learn natural systems and how we can still be productive while working in harmony with these systems. And one is the faulty idea now of efficiency, a belief and course of action, as you note, that we can improve the environment through our ingenuity. And then we falsely equate efficiency with conservation. Well, efficiency has been such a catchword in our culture. Fuel-efficient cars, energy-efficient appliances, efficient use of fossil fuels, efficient use of land and resources. However, our dogma of efficiency has resulted in higher consumption, and therefore there's been no recognizable decline in energy use. So please take your time and outline for us the problems and threats you see created by relying upon this idea of efficiency with some examples, and then present the alternative we need to be focused on, which is resilience and conservation.
Well, thanks for the introduction, Gary. I think you actually pretty much just explained it as well as I could, and probably convinced people they don't need to read my book because you said it perfectly. I think efficiency is one of the more important and interesting concepts that we have to contend within the modern world at the moment, because it's a concept that screams out to everybody, including environmentalists, as almost a moral requirement. It's a universal good. It's accepted by everybody as a good thing. Inefficiency, as I say in the book, is possibly even considered by many as the eighth deadly sin. And so efficiency apparently is a mechanism of saving fuel, and therefore making it last longer, and in the process causing it to emit less carbon dioxide, cause less environmental damage, save water, save soil, etc., etc., etc. The problem with efficiency is, of course, that what it ultimately does is the exact opposite. So where we have a problem with efficiency is, as with so many other things as humans, we're very quick to understand the short term, what happens quickly, and very slow to understand long-term ramifications. And so what efficiency does is give us a very noticeable but very short-term gain, but a much harder to detect, but much more important long-term problem. And it presents two problems, ultimately. It takes a while to sort of think through this, but there are two problems. The first is, where efficiency promises conservation, it actually, eventually, usually, causes consumption. The second problem is, as we drive for efficiency in all our systems, where it promises to control them, what it actually does is weaken them, make them more brittle, and make them more prone to failure. So efficiency is a really, really interesting concept. And what's really scary about it for me is that it seems to be the primary mechanism through which environmentalists, broadly speaking, have chosen to make their own personal attempt to improve the lot of the world, or save the world, if you will. But actually, in the process, what they're doing, I think, for the most part, is making things worse. There's a whole bunch of different angles we could go off and talk about this. I think one is actually what you raised before, which is perhaps the most complex way of looking at this, is to compare it with natural systems. If you want to go off on that direction, we can talk about that some.
I would. I'd like to focus also a bit on agriculture. You're a supporter of sustainable organic agriculture. However, you also find that the organic movement is falling prey to the efficiency trap as well. So please explain that. And in what ways is much of the rise in demand for organic produce and products denying the energy problems we are facing?
Right. So here's a really difficult one. And I think this is where I think the book is probably challenging to a lot of people. In agriculture, I think the biggest problem that we have personally is the huge reliance on energy in what I could perhaps quite glibly call industrial agriculture. So the majority of our agricultural output in the United States today is on very large, very mechanized, very efficient farms. I think it's quite easy to see that those farms have an enormous efficiency problem. They use vast amounts of fuel. They produce vast amounts of calories, but of very poor quality. They have extremely long supply chains, and they generate really bad food. Really, all they do generate is lots and lots of money that flows through the system into corporations and other groups. Clearly a disaster. What's particularly scary, though, is actually for me, is the organic industry. Because the organic industry, or the organic movement, emerged as a sort of an antithesis to big ag, and carried a lot of hope with it. But I think what's happened with the organic movement over the last few decades is, as it's turned into the organic industry, it's also fallen prey to the efficiency trap. So it's very efficient financially to get a fair amount of organic food from overseas, which to me is not sustainable. It's also very efficient to produce most of our organic food in a small number of corners of the country, particularly California, where we can exploit labor, where we have a particularly good climate that avoids disease. But ultimately what we do is we massively mechanize and make as efficient as possible this system, also put it together with long supply chains. And so essentially what's happened with the organic movement is I think it's sort of morphed into a second form of big ag that is no more sustainable than the first. So for me, we need now to work harder again and try and find what it was that was particularly strong about the organic movement when it first began, which for me was a form of agriculture that would increase diversity of farming practices, would protect soils, would reduce inputs, but would still be productive. So we find ourselves at this sort of second breaking point of agricultural production. We have two forms of agriculture that, to me, are problematic, corporate-owned, over-supported, over-subsidized, environmentally damaging, and need to be changed in many ways, and really need to be challenged by other forms of agriculture that are much more sustainable.
Two questions in one, if you would. With all the energy crisis we're facing today, with peak oil on the horizon, or at least the demise of easy, accessible fossil fuels, and having to increasingly rely on dirty oils like tar sands or highly expensive oil reserves in the Arctic or deep offshore drilling, we're told we simply need to use oil and gas more efficiently.
Right.
And I'd like for you to address what problems we see lying with current alternative energy sources like wind, solar, thermal, etc. And also, share with us some of the primary and most important solutions you believe we should be discussing at both the national and local levels. All right?
Yeah, okay. So there's quite a lot in there. So the first thing, if we talk about oil and efficiency. So here is the first misnomer. The general conception is that if we use fossil fuels more efficiently, that we will use less of them. So the idea is if that you trade in your car and get a slightly more efficient one, that you've saved gas. And in the process, you've saved carbon dioxide. So you've reduced emissions. The first really important point is that this is simply not true. Because what happens is, let's say even you take an extreme seeming example, you trade in your Hummer. I'm sure you have one, Gary. You trade in your Hummer for a Prius, okay? So you instantly convert yourself from being a gas guzzler to an environmentally sound driver, or relatively environmentally sound driver. The efficiency of the Prius is much greater than that of the Hummer. In fact, it's more or less double. So you can instantly see that if you were to drive the same amount, that you would use less gas. But here's the first problem. When people do change from a less efficient vehicle to a more efficient vehicle, on average, not everybody, and you may not do this and I may not do this, but on average people do tend to drive a little more. And through the history of the automobile, we can see this. As we move from Model T Ford to 57 Chevrolet, whatever, as we move through vehicles, they become more efficient. They use less gas per mile. So they would seem to save energy, but what happens is we need more cars. We drive more, we need more cars. As we have more cars, we need more roads. As we have more roads, of course, we need to build those roads, which takes energy. But as we have more roads, then we can put more cars on them. As we have more cars, we need more tires. That also takes energy. We have more tires, we need more rubber. Okay. Also on those extra cars, we need more steel, we need more paint, we need more plastics. And so what efficiency actually does is save in the very short term, in that one transaction when we're changing from one vehicle to another, there's a saving in the short term. But what it does is, of course, is it drives progress. And that's not necessarily a bad thing inherently, but we shouldn't fool ourselves that it saves energy, because it doesn't. the exact opposite happens. So as we go from more efficient vehicle to more efficient vehicle, we actually grow the system. We grow the automobile market. We increase the size of the roads. We increase the overall throughput, and we use more energy. So that's the first thing is, in trying to save energy by being more efficient, we're actually fooling ourselves. It won't work. Okay. So clearly, we are going to run out of oil and natural gas and coal, in that order, actually, as we move into the future. And we're hitting the peaks of these fossil fuels fairly soon. Oil around about now, natural gas in maybe quarter century at the most, and coal in various places already and in other places fairly soon. We'd like to save these fuels with efficiency, but that's not going to work. And in fact, efficiency is going to bring their demise faster. So if we want to maintain our way of life, I'm not sure we do, but if we do, then we need to replace these energy sources. And so we need to look at the plethora of options. And I think it's fairly clear what they are. They're what we call generally the renewables, wind, solar, hydro, etc. We also tend to talk about biofuels, but they're generally a bad idea, and also nuclear energy. So the question is, the vast amount of energy we get from fossil fuels, can we get that from the various alternatives that are available? This is a long discussion. Various people have different ideas. I think the general answer is no, and certainly not in the time frame required. So I think the really important point here is, if you accept that, and I'm not saying you need to, but if you accept that, then it faces us with a real issue that I think the first thing we need to do is face honestly. And if you're going to solve a problem, you need to really face up to what that problem is. We spend too much time assuming that somebody will find a technology that will save us, whatever that means. We spend too much time expecting scientists and technologists in particular to massively expand the nuclear industry or solve this problem or that problem and assume everything will be okay. I think if you change your mindset and say, okay, the most likely outcome here is that it's going to be really bad. We're going to have nowhere near the energy we need to drive this civilization, and this civilization is going to start to fall apart. For me, you need to look for solutions in that new mindset and stop looking for solutions that save the world. You need to start looking for solutions that make people's lives better in the world that we're going to have, which will be for a while a chaotic one, and then hopefully a rebuilding that comes after that. So this is one thing you mentioned in your introduction. You said we need to refocus on this word resilience. And I think that's where a lot of my focus in the book, in The Efficiency Trap, starts to try and steer us away from the idea of sustainability towards the idea of resilience. And this is a really big deal, because sustainability implies we're trying to sustain the world as it is, this massive global economy, the pollution we produce, this enormous population that's unsustainable, and quite literally unsustainable. All of these things, they cannot be sustained. What we need to do is be resilient. We need to accept that many things are going to break. There's going to be a high degree of economic and other kinds of chaos. And we need to figure out ways to bend without breaking in our own communities and our own spheres. So I think there's a fairly major mindset change needed, because I think things are going to be fairly ugly.
I appreciate your deep insights. And even though it leaves us on a little downbeat, it leaves us with a sobering reminder that we have to get real, not allow the so-called experts to save us. We have to start looking at what we're doing, how we're doing it, how much do we really need in order to have a quality of life. And your book, The Efficiency Trap, certainly guides sent in that direction. Thank you very much, Steve, for being on with us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Professor Steve Hallett, H-A-L-L-E-T-T, my guest. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening in and look forward to sharing more on our next program. By the way, we have a powerful progressive commentary hour tonight at 7 p.m. The topic, sociopathic natures of our oligarchical elite, a look at the abnormal relationship between money, power, and influence. Professor Joel Bacon will be on, and Professor Christopher Baer will be on, and they both have a lot to share, so you won't want to miss that. We're out of time. We'll just, I don't want to run into Utrece Lee's time. We'll just say hello to Utrece and see what she's got on her agenda today. Hi, Utrece.
Hello, Gary. Today, President Obama goes homey. He is talking today to the graduates at Morehouse, but in a really interesting way.
Oh, all right. Well, now you got us curious. We're going to have to tune in to hear Utrece Lee right now.